This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois is preparing a law that could legalize recreational use of marijuana. That leaves one nationally recognized illegal drug researcher stunned.
61% of the U.S. population favors full legalization of marijuana. I can't imagine that being true 10 years ago.
ISU criminal justice scientist Ralph Weisite talks with Willis Kern about legalizing pot in Illinois. For years, the Vietnam War had a profound effect on American foreign policy, but are those lessons remembered today? Judy Valente talks with a visiting Harvard scholar who has written extensively on the war. And we celebrate National Poetry Month with award-winning poet Cornelius Eaton. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's April 27th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. To provide sustainable transportation options for Bloomington Normal, connecting you in new ways with new Sunday service and an app for iPhone and Android that allows riders to track buses in real time. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois is preparing a law that could legalize recreational use of marijuana. That leaves one nationally recognized illegal drug researcher stunned.
61% of the U.S. population favors full legalization of marijuana. I can't imagine that being true 10 years ago.
ISU criminal justice scientist Ralph Weisite talks with Willis Kern about legalizing pot in Illinois. For years, the Vietnam War had a profound effect on American foreign policy, but are those lessons remembered today? Judy Valente talks with a visiting Harvard scholar who has written extensively on the war. And we celebrate National Poetry Month with award-winning poet Cornelius Eaton. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's April 27th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Pentagon says two American service members have been killed in Afghanistan. They died during combat operations against Islamic State. The announcement comes just 3 weeks after another American was killed in a similar fight. More on this from NPR's Tom Bowman.
U.S. officials say the two Americans were killed in Nangarhar province, right along the Pakistan border. Their names and unit affiliations are being withheld pending the next of kin notification. Just 3 weeks ago, Staff Sergeant Mark D'Alencar was killed in the same area fighting the Islamic State with Afghan commandos. ISIS had more than 2,000 fighters in the area, but officials say that number has dropped to about 800 with ongoing combat operations, including the dropping of a massive weapon nicknamed the Mother of All Bombs. Most American troops in Afghanistan work as trainers inside large bases, but hundreds of special operations forces are in combat, going after ISIS as well as Al-Qaeda. Tom Bowman, NPR News, Washington.
Congress has until midnight Friday to pass a spending bill that averts a partial government shutdown. Negotiators are getting closer to making that happen after the White House made another concession. President Trump had initially wanted to withhold payments sent to lower-income Americans under the Affordable Care Act. House Speaker Paul Ryan says Congress has posted an amendment to health care legislation, though he is not saying when he hopes it can be put to another vote.
We've not yet made any decisions on a vote, but this is more progress, and we will continue our progress and our work to repeal and replace Obamacare.
Last time, Ryan was unable to secure enough Republican support to put a draft for repealing and replacing Obamacare to a vote in the full House. Democrats and independents stood opposed. President Trump is revising his stance on the North American Free Trade Agreement.
I decided rather than terminating NAFTA, which would be a pretty big, shock to the system, we will renegotiate.
News comes as relief to the Mexican government. James Frederick has reaction from Mexico City.
Mexico's foreign minister, Luis Videgaray, told a Mexican TV network this morning that relations between the U.S. and Mexico had seen, quote, enormous progress over the last few months. Last night, Mexico's president, Enrique Peña Nieto, had a 20-minute phone call with President Trump in which they agreed to renegotiate NAFTA. Both sides say that will only work if all countries benefit, but neither has said exactly what that means. Either way, markets are reacting well to the news. After falling as much as 2% yesterday, the Mexican peso was up more than 1% in the first hours of trading on Thursday. For NPR News, I'm James Frederick in Mexico City.
U.S. stocks trading moderately higher, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 20 points at last glance at 20,995. The NASDAQ is up 23 points at 6,048. S&P is up 3, 2390. This is NPR. Amtrak says it will temporarily reduce rail service at New York's Penn Station this summer for urgently needed maintenance. NPR's Joel Rose reports the announcement about the nation's busiest passenger rail hub comes after a month of frequent disruptions.
Amtrak says it will replace worn-out tracks, signals, and switches, some of which date back to the 1970s. That failing infrastructure is blamed for delays that inconvenienced Amtrak riders, plus hundreds of thousands of daily commuters. CEO Wick Moorman says Amtrak has yet to finalize track closings and schedule changes with New Jersey Transit and the Long Island Railroad, which also use Penn Station. But he acknowledges there will be some inconvenience to riders.
We understand the frustration. We are responding to that frustration. We have to go in, step in, and get this work done.
Moorman says Amtrak had been planning to do the repair work on weekends over the next few years, but decided it simply can't wait any longer. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
The next time a passenger is bumped from a United Airlines flight, that person could be compensated with up to $10,000. United has announced that it is raising its limit on payments to customers who are forced to give up their seats on overbooked flights. The airline is in damage control mode after a series of highly publicized clashes with customers, including one in which a passenger was injured as he was dragged off a flight in Chicago. Since then, the airline CEO has been skewered in social media for his initial responses, widely criticized as unapologetic. The Dow is up 23. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the American Occupational Therapy Association, whose members provide health and wellness services across the lifespan to promote full participation in everyday life at AOTA.org, and Americans for the Arts at AmericansfortheArts.org.
From the GLT Newsroom, good afternoon. I'm John Norton. McLean County State's Attorney Jason Chambers says he's getting an outside lawyer for the county clerk in the matter of the Normal mayoral vote recount. Chambers says he's friends with Mayor Chris Koos and with another person who was involved with Koos's opponent, Mark Tiratilli. Chambers says hiring the appellate prosecutor's office won't make a difference to the public.
We have a flat fee that we pay them each year. It doesn't matter if we send them 1,000 cases, if we send them one case. It's all covered under that. So there's no additional expense to the taxpayers of McLean County. So it was one of those things where it's, all right, if there's no additional cost to the taxpayers, then let's go ahead and remove even the appearance of a conflict.
A partial recount will happen the second week in May. Tiratilli will look over a quarter of the precincts involved in his 11-vote loss to Mayor Chris Koos in hopes of turning up something to convince a judge a full recount is merited. McLean County administrators say a mailing service messed up 4,000 property tax bills and sent them out a week ago. Those bills went to the individuals or entities who own more than one piece of taxable land in the county. Those 4,000 people or entities own 11,000 parcels of land out of the total 69,000 parcels in the county. Administrator Bill Wasson says those bills all had the same property tax ID number printed on them. New bills are going out as soon as possible. Wasson says the contractor, Mail Services LLC, is eating the cost of the mailing and apologizes for the confusion. Parking lots in the northeast part of downtown Bloomington purchased by the city may not remain as parking lots for long. That's according to Mayor Terry Renner, speaking during GLT's Sound Ideas.
The frontier lots are critical, and they're critical to economic development and having, frankly, from the standpoint of the city, control over property. We're finding that, obviously, with the front and center building, if you don't have control of the property, there are limitations as to how you can operate.
The front and center building has been the target of several hotel development proposals. The city does not own the building. Alderman approved the purchase of the four lots on a 7-1 vote at a cost of $961,000. The four parking lots are south of the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts and located on Douglas Street, Northeast Street, and East Market Street. Bloomington Economic Development Coordinator Austin Grammer says the lots will alleviate a parking deficit for BCPA events in the short term. The head of the Unit 5 school district says state legislators need to fund schools as soon as possible. Superintendent Mark Daniels says he will join many superintendents and State Senator Jason Berrickman of Bloomington in Springfield to jumpstart discussion of a proposed new way to fund schools. But a budget should come first, he says.
Again, you can't really do anything with a model if you don't have revenue. So the budget's the first piece, but the evidence-based formula, revising that to ensure that schools are adequately funded is the next major step after budget.
Daniel says the state is $10 million behind in grants for Unit 5 transportation costs, free and reduced lunch, and special education. Daniel says he hopes lawmakers will pick up a funding model that will help every district instead of schools in specific areas of the state. Bloomington school leaders want to reassure students the district won't embarrass them if they can't afford to pay for lunch. The emphasis on confidentiality policies comes in the wake of national news accounts of some students getting ink stamps on a hand if they don't have enough money. Superintendent Barry Riley says schools keep in touch with parents to arrange payment schedules.
There have been numerous communications with parents, guardians of those children to try to work on a plan that allows them to work through that in a way that works for them.
More than half the student body in District 87 qualifies for free or reduced price lunch. Riley says schools will only provide an alternative lunch as a last resort. He says the alternative lunch meets nutritional standards for daily lunches. Cloudy, windy through the afternoon, 56 the high. Morning showers likely tomorrow and a high of 65. I'm John Norton. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Proposed legislation in Illinois would make recreational use of marijuana legal. The proposal would allow possession of up to 1 ounce by people 21 and over, smoking in public would be prohibited, and driving under the influence would remain illegal. Sponsors of the bill say the measure won't get a vote this legislative season, but they're beginning a series of hearings on how to craft the law. This comes on the heels of Illinois' highly restrictive medical pot program. GLT's Willis Kern talks with ISU Distinguished Professor of Criminal Justice Sciences and a researcher of illegal drugs and rural crime since the 1980s. Ralph Weisheit says the way Illinois regulates medical marijuana could eventually help the state set up recreational use programs.
I think the fact that the medical system is so restrictive is actually a good thing for the producers, because the last thing you want if you're producing marijuana is to have the current Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, come down on you for misusing the right to give out medical. And in a really restrictive environment, it's pretty easy for the state to argue, look, we're doing this right. We're doing this in a careful way. And what they can do is piggyback the recreational on top of the medical. So they can say, look, we've got incredible restrictions on the production and monitoring the production. We've got incredible restrictions on routinely testing the quality of the product for herbicides and for potency. We've got incredible restrictions on how this can be distributed. We can use that same network for recreational, and the odds of the feds coming after us go down dramatically.
The more restrictive you would have in a situation, does that make it less productive on an economic sense? Are you likely to sell less of that or market less of it because it's so restrictive?
It certainly makes it more expensive. There's no question about that. You compare it to California, which has the least restrictive system in the country. Essentially, for medical in California, you can go into any doctor and just say, my toe hurts, or I've got this weird tingling in my arm and I think it would feel better with marijuana. And the doctor will say, okay, you can have marijuana.
That's not the way it's set up here in Illinois.
Oh, no. We have a very restricted list of conditions. You have to actually have a continuing relationship with a doctor. You cannot just walk into any clinic and have an anonymous doctor sign off on things. These are conditions that, for the most part, are clearly diagnosable. So you cannot, for chronic pain in Illinois, you cannot get marijuana. The most vague condition in Illinois would be PTSD, which, although it's vague in terms of how you diagnose it, it's pretty clear. It's not something that people typically just make up.
And the most common usage, I guess, might be with cancer treatment. Is that the most common?
A couple of things. It can be in the treatment of cancer for treating nausea that goes along with cancer. It is extremely useful for people who have sometimes depression. Although that's in Illinois, that's not typically used. It's used that way in other states quite often. the list is pretty long. It's things you might not expect. Crohn's disease, for example. I mean, it's a very specific listing, and I don't know if I can't think of any one condition that stands out as the most common.
There's a major cultural shift on attitudes toward cigarette smoking and tobacco use in general in the United States. How does this legal pot movement fit in with this shift?
It doesn't. I mean, I've been looking at this issue of drug policy for a long time. And if 20 years ago someone had said to me, we're going to have medical marijuana in much of the country, we're going to have recreational marijuana, I would have laughed and said, there's no way that's going to happen because it's getting harder and harder to smoke tobacco anywhere. It's getting harder and harder to find food products that don't have the extensive labeling because we're very concerned about what's in our food. And it seems that going toward marijuana is a move in the opposite direction.
But is it maybe marijuana replacing tobacco as far as some sort of accepted vice maybe?
Actually, the drug that's being replaced in some jurisdictions is alcohol. And it's no accident that alcohol manufacturers and distributors have been some of the biggest opponents of marijuana legalization.
Yeah, I guess because of the high factor, right?
That's right.
So how would you say attitudes have shifted?
Some recent polls, and by recent I mean within the last couple of weeks, have come out that are just stunning to me. 61% of the U.S. population favors full legalization of marijuana. I can't imagine that being true 10 years ago. 94% of the population favors medical marijuana. That's amazing to me. I never would have predicted that.
What were the comparable figures, say, 5 years or 10 years ago?
Anecdotally, I would say 10 years ago, if you would have had 30-35% favoring legalization, that would have been a lot. The medical, you might have had 60%. You would have never had 94%. Interestingly enough, also, there is, of course, this conflict between federal law and state law. 70% of the public wants the federal government to keep its nose out of what states do on the issue of marijuana.
And that's pretty much what's happened, right?
That's pretty much what's happened, although we'll see what happens under the new attorney general, who has a personal contempt for marijuana. And I don't think he's doing political posturing. I think it's deeply felt. And he thinks there's no such thing as a good use of marijuana or a safe use. He sees it as many ways equivalent to heroin. And he is the attorney general, which means that he can direct the enforcement of federal laws. I should also point out that there are some really interesting practical things about this from a law enforcement perspective. As with any bureaucracy, numbers matter. And so if you want more money for enforcing DUI, you can show that we have lots of DUIs and we could use another squad car to do that. Nationally, 40% of all drug-related arrests are for marijuana. And most of those are simple possession. If you take those away,
it gives the cops something else to do, right?
It gives them something else to do is the positive. The negative is it's harder for them to argue they need lots of money for drug enforcement.
Because there is not a whole lot of drug enforcing to do.
The numbers are just smaller.
Yeah.
And, of course, they can shift to emphasizing heroin, for example, or methamphetamine. But it is – numbers have an impact. Numbers matter. And – so they will have to figure out how do we continue to argue for large grants to go after drugs. If our numbers go down, we lose 40% of our arrests. Mm. I think they can make that argument, but they're going to have to figure out how to do it convincingly. The other important thing to note is this move toward medical just doesn't stop. Mid-April, we had the West Virginia legislature pass and the governor sign medical marijuana, which is something of a landmark because it means now 29 states and the District of Columbia now have medical marijuana. That accounts for about 2/3 of the U.S. population is now covered by that. We also have 9 states with about 20% of the U.S. population with legalization. And not only that, but in states where they haven't legalized, they are continuously reducing penalties. We have the Houston, Texas, the county there is the third largest county in the country. Their prosecutor, and no one would claim Texas is liberal on much of anything, their prosecutor has decided they will no longer prosecute small marijuana cases. They said that they deal with about 10,000 of those a year, and it's costing them about $25 million to do it, and it's not worth it financially. So when you have a Texas prosecutor deciding that small levels of marijuana just aren't worth prosecuting, That's a real sea change in mindset.
Last week, the head of Colorado's legal pot program told lawmakers here in Illinois that she believes the legal market for marijuana is eating into the black market, funding drug abuse treatment and prevention, and providing a safer product overall. I would think this is exactly what Colorado voters wanted when they chose to legalize pot a few years back. What can you tell us about how Colorado's program has worked out?
It has worked out better than I think anyone expected. Critics were projecting doom and gloom that particularly high school age kids would be getting free access, that crime would go up. None of those things have happened. In fact, the most recent surveys suggest that marijuana use by young people is about where it was before these relaxed regulations went into place. And by the way, I say relaxed for adults. They were never relaxed for juveniles. It was always illegal for juveniles to have these.
So if you're living in Colorado and you're not noticing things like more homelessness or increased poverty, things like that, this is not being increased because of people are using more pot. In other words, an extension of, I guess, an alcohol situation.
The sky wasn't falling after all these relaxed regulations went into place. And by the way, one of the things that I don't think it's talked about enough, and you mentioned it very briefly, but I think it's an important point. When you buy any illegal drug on the black market, you never know what's in it. It's one of the reasons why people are dying of heroin overdose, because of the other things that are put in with the heroin. And that's true with marijuana. I know that in some communities they've found that what looks like marijuana is actually basically a bunch of green leafy matter with PCP sprayed on it. When you have a legal market, as in Colorado, at least you can be sure of the purity. You can be in Illinois' proposed law, for example, it's very clear that the product is to be tested for not only contaminants but for level of the active ingredient THC. And so it is safer in that regard. But beyond that is an important point that I don't think enough people take into consideration. If you buy marijuana on the black market, you increase your odds of dealing with someone who also has access to cocaine and heroin and methamphetamine. If you buy your marijuana through the legal channels, you're not getting access to those other sources. And so I think it has a real potential to reduce people's access to these other illegal drugs.
But the people who control the illegal black market of drug dealing, when their market dries up, aren't there other areas they're going to choose to break the law or gain some sort of financial advantage?
They're clearly going to increase marketing, and they're clearly going to increase efforts to get people to use. I just think it'll take more work on their part. It's going to be harder. And these other drugs, by the way, won't go away. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just suggesting that people who are trying things, experimenting with drugs, will have to make a more concerted effort if they want to get to these other harder drugs.
They'll probably make drugs stronger and more attractive, maybe. Say that you can buy your over-the-counter stuff, sure, but what I have for you here is really going to turn you on more.
And price will matter. We may see the price. I mean, one of the things we've seen with the current heroin crisis is as they put restrictions on access to prescription pills, the price of those pills on the street, on the underground market, went up dramatically, and heroin actually became cheaper. And so if you have to choose, you're an addict and you want to buy a supply, you're going to go with the cheaper source.
Ralph Weisheit is a distinguished professor of criminal justice sciences at Illinois State University and a nationally recognized researcher in the field of illegal drugs and rural crime. You can read more about Weisheit and his work at WGLT.org and in the latest edition of Redbird Scholar Magazine. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Harvard University professor Frederick Loegewald was a child living in Canada when the United States pulled its combat forces out of Vietnam in 1973. As an expert in international affairs, Loegewald felt it was crucial to understand this complicated and controversial part of American history. He's since written several books about the war and shared his insights recently at Illinois State University. Loegewald says that for decades, the war had a profound effect on U.S. foreign policy, but some of its lessons still aren't heeded.
I think it made Americans, including elected leaders, it made them wary of military interventions in far-flung places in the world. Not altogether a bad thing, I think. I think Vietnam, they refer to the ghosts of Vietnam in political parlance, I guess you'd say. And I think that it affected, therefore, views on when the United States should intervene, under what conditions it should go in militarily. And I think for about a decade or so, that held. Over time, I think the memory of it, or at least the perception of what Vietnam represented, changed, and you saw more military interventions, of course.
In your writings, you make the case that the Vietnam War was avoidable. People in hindsight would say, yes, that's absolutely true, but that was more difficult to see at the time, wasn't it? And in what way would it have been? Could it have been avoidable at that time?
Well, I think you ask a very good question about this. Was it avoidable in the context of its own time? Because, as you say, that's key. I think what's crucial, and maybe what I find in terms of my own work, the most important finding in my research, is that at the time, whether you're talking the late 40s, in terms of the French War and backing what the French were doing, because they, of course, were there before the Americans, or later on, under Lyndon Johnson in the mid-1960s, under Richard Nixon in the late 60s. At the time, there were people who said, Mr. President, this is not a war that the United States needs to fight. This is not a national security priority for the United States. In other words, what happens in Vietnam isn't going to be decisive to our security. And moreover, it's not at all clear that we can win, even with major American ground forces, even with sustained bombing of North Vietnam and of enemy-held areas in the South. So I think your question is good, but I do feel confident in saying at the time there were these skeptics and pessimists who, moreover, argued that it is avoidable, that you can choose a path that avoids this becoming an American war.
Are there parallels between the Vietnam War and the wars that we're involved in today in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria?
Yeah, I think there are parallels. I think the most important one is that what Vietnam shows and what these later conflicts show is that local actors are ultimately key. So if you're the United States, you need to have a local government that fulfills its end of the bargain, that does what it's supposed to do, that is committed to working to sustain the country, to protect its citizens. That was ultimately lacking in South Vietnam. That's not to say that there weren't South Vietnamese who were committed and who were courageous and who wanted to defend South Vietnam. There just weren't enough of them. And the local governments, a whole string of governments in South Vietnam, really, were never sufficiently popular and didn't have sufficient popular support. You could say the same about our more recent conflicts. So that in Kabul, for example, in Afghanistan, just to give one, same kind of phenomenon. Too much corruption. You have too much of a central government that is lacking in these prerequisites. It doesn't matter how powerful you are as the United States. It doesn't matter how much military power you can bring to bear. If you don't have that local government, your power is ultimately limited. So it's really a question in a way of, it's an issue of the limits of American military power.
Does it suggest that we did not learn the lessons of the Vietnam War or that we just never learn?
I think it does suggest a failure to learn, or at least a failure to remember what we've learned. I think that there is in the United States a tendency to believe that technology, and in particular America's technological might, will win out in the end. And so it becomes very seductive to believe, maybe in the age of Trump, as it has been the case in previous administrations, that surely our tremendous military power which is unlike anything the world has ever seen before, will prevail. And the temptation to use military power becomes, if not irresistible, at least very strong. And I think that's what we've seen. It involves, at least on some level, a failure to remember or to learn in the first place what Vietnam demonstrated about the limits of military power.
You have written a great deal about Ho Chi Minh, of course, who is a key figure in the whole Vietnam War. And you say that he may just be the most misunderstood figure in recent history. That seems a rather mild or kind assessment of someone who forced his own people into re-education camps and was brutal to his own countrymen. Talk a little bit about how you reach that assessment.
I do think that Ho Chi Minh is a really fascinating figure and very important in the 20th century international history. And in my last book, Embers of War, I look very closely at his rise and how he became the most important leader of the Vietnamese nationalist movement, if you want to call it that. And I am ultimately somewhat sympathetic to him. I think that he was a very dedicated nationalist. He believed for a very long time, maybe this is part of the reason for my sympathy, believed for a very long time that the United States, which itself was a product of an anti-colonial reaction to Great Britain, the United States would be there for him and for his country. So you could argue that he was even naive in the length of time that he thought the Americans would come to support what he was doing. Now, you're quite right that his government could be brutally repressive. I do not in any way wish to romanticize either Ho or his lieutenants, his government. But I think that he was ultimately a nationalist. I think he could have worked with the United States. This is another one of those what-ifs. I think he could have worked with the United States. I'm not saying he would have been an American ally. He did believe in Marxism-Leninism as the best course of development for his country. But he's a powerful and, to my mind, in some way, what's the word? Well, sympathetic figure.
Let's talk about people who are somewhat forgotten in these historical retrospectives about the Vietnam War, and that is the American soldiers.
Mm, yes.
The people who fought it, and the South Vietnamese soldiers as well. That war seemed to have a tremendous effect, psychological effect, in ways that we didn't see in World War I or World War II, as brutal as those wars were.
Well, we should say that the experience of the American soldier in Vietnam varied considerably. And so, you know, some came back from the experience one way, others were much more deeply affected, I guess is a fair thing to say. I think an important reason for the difference, I've thought a lot about this, is that I think as the war went on, so as we get into 1967, 68, 69, 70, American soldiers came to realize, maybe just in their gut, maybe more intellectually, that, you know, our leaders aren't quite committed to this thing. Lyndon Johnson can't fully explain why I'm over here getting shot at, risking my life. What is the purpose of this? I think that became harder and harder to answer for many, not all. Some were committed right to the end. The other thing to be said about this, of course, is that now we know, because of archival releases, that skepticism was warranted. That is to say, we now know that Johnson and Nixon and Kennedy before them did have these doubts about the importance of this struggle. So I think it's partly that. It's partly also the conditions under which they fought in Vietnam. Not knowing who was friend, not knowing who was enemy, that was very trying. A sense that leaders back home were maybe micromanaging the war. Finally, I guess one would say about the response. Finally, maybe the response or the reaction when they returned to the United States was difficult in many cases.
How do you assess the impact of the anti-war movement, which was extremely strong by the late 60s and into the 70s? Did that also add to the failure of this military intervention?
I think that the legacy or the importance of the anti-war movement is much debated by historians, and people come down reasonably on different sides of this. I think the anti-war movement got some things wrong. It tended to romanticize Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Cong. It tended, in my view, to exaggerate the economic motivations for American intervention, which I don't happen to think were all that important. But it's also the case, in my view, that the anti-war movement, including obviously people on college campuses, including ultimately members of Congress, even though they were late, I think, in coming, members of the press, ordinary people, I think that the anti-war movement limited the options available to first Lyndon Johnson and then Richard Nixon, which is to say that they put limits on what the president could do in terms of escalating the war. And I think that when Richard Nixon comes in, he understands that he has to reduce to some extent American involvement in this war. And that's at least partly a function of this anti-war agitation. So it had a role.
We're talking about the Vietnam War with Professor Frederick Loegewal of the International Studies Department at Harvard University. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your insights about this important event in 20th century history.
It's been a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
I'm Judy Valente.
Though it's called the Vietnam War, Congress never actually declared war on Vietnam. It is, however, the longest conflict in U.S. history. About two-thirds of the soldiers who fought in Vietnam were volunteers. 55,000 lost their lives in the conflict. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. On Sound Ideas.
Your garden after winter, some plants are barely alive.
We can rebuild it. We have the technology. We have the know-how to make your garden grow. We can make it better than before. Better, greener, growier.
Bring new life to your garden with advice from Murph on Grow. Tomorrow at 8:50 and 4:50 on GLT. Send your gardening questions to WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Castle Theater, where Texas singer-songwriter Ray Wiley Hubbard serves up a full plate of gritty Americana, bluesy red dirt music, roots rock, country, and folk. Show at 8 p.m. Thursday, May 4th. Tickets at thecastletheater.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, celebrate National Poetry Month with award-winning writer and poet Cornelius Eady. Judy Valente has the interview on the way. I'm Mike McCurdy. More and more people are keeping less and less cash in their wallets. But is what's left over in your wallet something that should be there? GLT's Willis Kern investigates during this edition of Sound Money.
Edgar Norton, director of ISU's Institute for Financial Planning and Analysis, is with us. Edgar, we've all seen those Capital One commercials. Some of the most popular are with the actor Samuel L. Jackson, who asks, "What's in your wallet?" They're advertising a rewards card. Exactly what are we talking about when we say a rewards card?
Well, it is a credit card, but for every dollar you spend, you get a reward back. It could be 1% or 2% of the amount of the transaction that you can then ask the credit card company to either send you a check or put that money in a savings account or use it to buy gift cards for some store that they have a connection with.
So in some way, you're getting some kind of a minor savings on each transaction.
You're getting a little bit of a reward back. And some cards, instead of giving you cash, they give you airline miles. And so if you're one that likes to take some trips, especially in the wintertime to warm places or summertime to cooler places, or you want to go see Europe, you can use a reward card and get some airplane miles that way and cash those in and help you with your trip.
So, gee, they sound fantastic. Why would you not want a rewards card in your wallet?
Well, they give with the left hand and take with the right hand or vice versa. They have to get the money to give you those rewards, and they do that by fees and by the interest rates that they charge. If you're the kind of person that pays off that credit card bill in full every month, the rewards card is probably going to work in your favor. If you're the average person And we've seen some stats where the average credit card balance is around $6,000 today, and you're paying interest on that every month. Then the rewards card may not be in your best interest, because you may be paying a higher interest in order to get the rewards. And when you actually look at the numbers, maybe you're paying out more in interest than you're actually getting in cash back or airline miles.
So when it comes to what's in your wallet, Edgar, I guess there are some things you should have in your wallet, maybe some things you shouldn't. So I thought maybe we would kind of just go through a wallet. I have my wallet here, and we can kind of talk about what I have in my wallet and whether or not I should have this or not. First of all, my driver's license here. I should have my driver's license in the wallet, right?
That's a good idea, especially if you're driving.
Uh-huh. Now, if I open up the main area where you put bills in and everything, I open it up here, and I have some ones, and I think I have about...
Grants and Franklins?
I have about... Five ones, and then I have a couple of 20s here, but I also have a whole bunch of, how many of these receipts? These are like from eating out, receipts from eating out, things like that. They're in my wallet. So the money's a great idea. You should have money in your wallet, right?
That sounds like, I like money in my wallet.
What about all these receipts? Here's one from, where is this from? Kick's Bar and Grill in Towanda. I think we had some burgers there. Here's one from... Well, this is from a trip that I made to Ecuador. I still have
How old is that receipt?
This is just a couple of months old. Another one from Ecuador. But then I have more recent ones here. A receipt from where I get my hair cut. Here's one from Avanti's.
You get your hair cut, Willis?
I do, believe it or not. So are these good things to have to keep around in my wallet?
Well, if you carry your wallet... In your back pocket, you're going to get sciatica from having that big, thick wallet with all those receipts in there.
Yeah, that's true. I believe that.
But on the financial side, I bet I can go through those receipts and I'll learn your. If I don't know you, I'll learn what your name is, and maybe I'll learn some of the digits of your credit card numbers or your debit card number, and I'll learn more about where you go, and maybe nights you're likely to be out eating out. Perhaps if I see a couple of Monday night receipts there, you know, if I'm a nasty person, I can say okay. This person's not home, but on Monday night. So
on Monday night, they go to Avanti's, so I can go to their home on Monday night because I know they're going to be out eating.
So I can just learn more about you and some of your finances, your name and part of your credit card number.
So how often should you clean these receipts out from your wallet?
Like when you get home, every day?
Every day, daily.
Put them. I guess another question is, why do you carry the receipt if you want to keep it to make sure your credit card statement is correct? You know, just put them in a safe place, and when your credit card statement comes, you can check things off and then shred the receipts. Just don't throw them in the trash, because that's worse than keeping them in your wallet. Mm-hmm. You want to shred those. Or if you buy a big-ticket item and you want to make sure it works okay, you know, again, put that off to the side. But then once you're satisfied that the item's working correctly or the warranty period ends, just shred that receipt.
I have a trifold wallet, and on the left side, there's an area where you can put a bunch of cards, and so I have... there's my health card. There's my ISU ID card. I have my insurance card for my car, a couple of personal type cards from church, things like that. Are those okay to have in your wallet?
Well, what you just said sounds okay. An issue might be is if you have three or four varieties of Discover Visa cards.
Well, we haven't gotten over to the right side yet. This is just on the left
side. Oh, my. Well, obviously, the driver's license, the health insurance card is good, and other things that you might need. The car insurance card, don't know if you need that in your wallet. You can keep that in your car, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Again, anything that has your name on it is potentially a danger signal, but as we know, that driver's license will be in your wallet, and that gives a lot of people a lot of information if they're nasty folks.
So now over to the right side, I have my main debit card here. I have another, looks like I have four or five other cards here. It looks like another credit card. Here's a third credit card. Here's a card from a grocery store. Here's my health club card, my card for my American Red Cross blood donation. So what have I got wrong there?
If you're carrying more than two credit cards, you're probably carrying too many. Because if for some reason one credit card doesn't work in the reader, the other one will, or the reader's broken, in which case it's not a credit card issue. The issue might be is if you have three or four, you know, well-known credit cards, then you have a bunch of store credit cards. And so, okay, if you're going to the store, you might want to get that one credit card and take it with you so you can get the you know, charge up that account if you so desire, get the reward for that. But there's no need to carry around five store credit cards and three or four other credit cards. And again, you lose those, boy, you're calling up a lot of credit card companies and messing up a lot of accounts.
Just by you, if I left my wallet somewhere, I'd have to backtrack all those places.
That's correct.
Some people carry their Social Security card around. I think I did when I was much younger, but that was when I was looking for work regularly, things like that. You shouldn't really carry your Social Security card around.
I think back years ago, it was more accepted, perhaps, to carry around your Social Security card as a form of identification. But now that Social Security number is so vital for so many financial and other transactions, you don't want to give that out unless you have to, and you really don't need to carry it around with you unless you are going in for that first day on the job and they need to fill out the I-9 form and other ways to prove your identity. Something else people used to do when in years gone by is carry their checkbook with them. And again, I don't see that so much now because credit cards are so ubiquitous. But again, if you're carrying around your checkbook, that's you like to pay by checks. Okay, that's a danger now because you lose that. Bingo, I can start writing off checks and forging your signature, and I might get some money.
And now the smartphones have the cases where you have slots built in where you can put credit cards or maybe a $20, $50 bill, something like that. Should you use those?
Or you can go to a store and buy something to stick on the back of your smartphone. And boy, so you lose your smartphone. You also lose your credit cards. You know, it sounds like we're awfully hyper here about losing stuff, but, you know, that does happen. Things get lost, misplaced, stolen. And if you lose your phone, now you've lost some other important things as well. And since you've lost your phone, it makes it tougher to call those credit card companies to actually cancel or get new credit cards issued. In fact, good advice here, if you haven't done it yet, is to make a photocopy of all your credit cards and other important information and just store that away somewhere safe at home. So if you do lose a credit card or your wallet does get stolen, you know what your account numbers are. Many times your credit card will say, you know, call this 800 number in case of an emergency or in case your card gets stolen.
So, and if you don't have your card, you can't look at that number.
That's right. I have no idea who to call. And so, yeah, if you have that on a photocopy somewhere, you'll be ready in case that unfortunate event happens.
So maybe a way to sum it all up is that what you should have in your wallet is things you use every day is what you should have in your wallet. Money.
Or might need when that friendly police officer pulls you over. You want to make sure you have your driver's license there. But yeah, less is more in this case. You don't want to carry around too much that has a financial exposure.
So what's in your wallet? You better open it up and check it out because there are many things in there you probably can remove right now. Edgar Norton is the director of ISU's Institute for Financial Planning and Analysis. As always, Edgar, thanks for coming over.
My pleasure, Willis.
I'm Willis Kern.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Across the nation, it's National Poetry Month. Poet Cornelius Eady recently visited Illinois Wesleyan University to speak with writing students and give a public reading of his work. Eady is the winner of the prestigious Lamont Poetry Prize and has been a finalist for the National Book Award. He's also co-founder with poet Toy Duricott of Cave Canem, a Brooklyn-based center that supports the work of African-American poets. Cave Canem championed the early work of many poets who went on to win the Pulitzer Prize or National Book Award. Eady tells GLT's Judy Valente there were few books in his home when he was growing up in Rochester, New York.
Yesterday, I was talking to some students about the immutable factor of luck in becoming a writer. Luck of encountering a really good mentor. It was a high school teacher. Her name then was Joanna Mason. And
God bless those high school teachers.
I like to think that if you scratch the surface of most poets, you would find that person. Maybe not a high school student.
Right. I have one in my own life.
See, that's what I mean. Exactly. Yeah. We all have them, right?
Who made me a poetry lover for life.
Yeah, exactly. That one person, right?
Yeah.
And that was the one person. She was also the editor of the high school literary magazine. And so I had written some dry lyrics and got them published in the high school literary magazine because she really liked me and I was a precocious kid. One of the poems was a poem about Martin Luther King, who had just been assassinated. And it was a really, I mean, just awful poem, right? But
can you remember any of the lines from it?
Sure. And if this world is so great, why am I second rate? Why? That was the end of the poem. I can't remember everything else from it, but that was the gist of the poem. And it changed the perception in the sense of the way the people looked at me and the way I looked at the world. Once the magazine was published and out in the world, the high school that I attended was a very large high school, and suddenly I was a poet. But I didn't know what that meant. Right? I was a very precocious kid. I loved going to libraries. Libraries were just these incredible houses for me. Like I said, I grew up in a house that didn't have books. We didn't have books. We barely had a radio.
What did your parents do?
My mother was a housewife, and my father worked first in construction and then at the city water department, you know, for all of his adult life. But the library was this serene, welcoming place that let you wander around. It was clean. It was quiet. There was no chaos about it, and had these little rooms that you could discover things. You could find things, right? And I'm the sort of kid that loved to go and look at the Encyclopedia Britannica, start reading about nuclear energy, and start reading about you know flying squirrels, and start reading about these other things. And I really loved that kind of curiosity. But it wasn't about the arts. It wasn't about writing until the poem got published, and then people started calling me a poet. And my high school teacher was the person that sort of encouraged that. You know, soon afterwards she moved off to live off the land in Nova Scotia, where she still lives. And I would send her packets of quote unquote poems, drafts. And she was the person who took it seriously, who read it and gave me feedback. That's what I was doing when I was a little kid, you know. And that's the person that sort of put me on that path. And so instead of going up to the technical stuff, I started going downstairs to the literary, right? Started reading, discovering poetry books. What's poetry, right? What I thought, the brief encounter I had with poetry when I was a teenager was things like, there was the same, you know, soup de jours everyone got when you're a kid in high school.
Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson,
right? Robert Frost, right? Langston Hughes as the one black poet. And that was fine, you know, but what did it have to do with me? So I started discovering in the library, you know, what it had to do with me. I was starting to find poets like The Beats, for example, and I think there was a really great book buyer who I've always wanted to meet in the 60s. Whoever that book buyer was in the 60s was buying poetry books, probably buying the books because no one was paying attention to them, to him buying them. But he'd buy the New Directions books, and he'd buy the City Lights books, and he'd buy all these other kind of obscure small press books.
Which had the avant-garde poetry.
Right, had
poetry
the avant-garde
at the time.
Poetry, and suddenly it was like, oh my God, this is what poetry might be like. Right.
Well, you mentioned music, and I'm wondering who were your musical influences, because you still write lyrics.
Yes. Like I said, the funny thing about this is it's an unguided journey, right? There wasn't anybody saying you should read this or not read this, or you should listen to this and not that. And I hate to say it, make it sound like some sort of, you know, that old trope. We were so poor, but we were so poor. We didn't have a record player. So the library was also my jukebox, right? Play it. So because of that, I had a really sort of, you know, bizarre kind of taste in music. Right.
So it ranged from
anything. I mean, you could be listening to Bach, to Johnny Cash, to, you know, Van Dyke Parks. The first time I heard The Doors was at the library. First time I heard Jimi Hendrix was at the library. And it was really cool because it, you know, you're listening to it by yourself. Right. It isn't like a show. It isn't like you're in a room with a lot of people. You're sitting there in a room with a turntable and headphones on your head,
right.
And headphones on your head. And whatever that experience is now between you and that music.
Well, you are a walking advertisement, PSA announcement for public libraries.
Yes.
You know that, right?
Oh, yeah. I know exactly what I'm saying. I mean, I adore libraries. I think it's a good reminder of what's good about us.
I want to talk to you a little bit about Cave Canem, which is the kind of the workshop publishing house that you created with Toy Derricotte, another poet, for showcasing the work of our great African-American poets. What has been the contribution, in your view, of Cave Canem?
The thing about Cave Canem, to me, it's still about the fellow who, up until that point, felt that he or she was by themselves, that what they were thinking was just their thoughts, and they maybe might even be a little crazy about it. And it's about that moment where they can walk into that room and write the poem they couldn't write anyplace else. I mean, that to me is still the essence of what Kaveh Khan really is. And it emboldens that person then to go back out into the world. Once they get those tools, they go back in the world, know how to do it. Also, they go back out into that world and understand that they're not the only one out there.
And you really introduced a number of poets who went on to win major prizes and to do great work.
Oh, that's the gravy. That's the gravy. We weren't planning that. That wasn't something that we were out to do when we started Kaveh Khan. And I celebrate that so many writers out there are now out there, you know, blazing. Tracy K. Smith, Terrence Hayes, Natasha Trethewey.
Who won the Pulitzer Prize.
Who won the Pulitzer. Greg Pardlow, who won the Pulitzer. You know, it's shifted the idea of what we think African-American poetic actually is. It isn't just the clenched fist in the pain, though it encompasses that. But it also encompasses so many other layers of experience. I think maybe one way of thinking about this is that it liberates the idea of what we think African-American poetry is about and can be about. And it pushes...
What is it about?
It can be about anything you want. I mean, when I would teach, sometimes I teach African-American poetry and undergrad level, and I would tell my students, or tell a workshop sometimes, anything that African-American writes is African-American poetry. If you wanted to be experimental and you're African-American, that's African-American poetry, right? If you want to be a traditionalist, then that is African-American poetry, right? You know, you get to define what that means in the parameters and the definition of your own life and your own art. No one else gets to name that. You get to claim that. You get to own that.
What would you advise a young aspiring poet who might be listening to you today? What advice would you give him or her?
Well, I'm going to tell you one thing about all poets. You're going to do it regardless. You're going to do it. You're going to find a way of doing it. And there will be obstacles. There will be things that get in the way. There will be things that will deter you. There will be things that will make you doubt. There will be times you think, you know, why you're wasting your life on this stuff. But in the end, you know, it's the only way. It's the only answer that makes sense for you in this life. Now, maybe what you're thinking about is will I be successful as a poet, right? You know, or will my poetry get noticed, or where will it get the acclaim that I want to do? And we're all ambitious, but so much of poetry has nothing to do with this. And I'd like to tell that young poet, you know, you can do it. You have to stick at it. Persistence is really the trick. Usually when I start a workshop, I tell them the three things you can't teach in a workshop. You can't teach experience, you can't teach ambition, and you can't teach luck. That's up to the poet, how they're going to apply that. And luck, to me, my definition of luck is the door opens. But you have to be prepared for that. You have to keep at your craft. You have to be, you know, you have to keep at it. And I would also say, you know, find allies. Find people, you know, that aren't trying to tear you down, that aren't trying to discourage you. Being a poet is a really important thing. It really is. I really think, especially given the moment we're all passing through politically, I think it is one of the most necessary things. The life and the imagination is really, really crucial. And then you see proof of that by noticing how much energy is being expended to try to shut it down.
Would you be so kind as to read one of your poems?
Sure. Okay. I'll read this one. The poem's called I'm a Fool to Love You, and it's a poem that came about when I asked my mother how did she and my father meet. This is the story she told me. I'm a fool to love you. Some folks will tell you the blues is a woman. Some type of supernatural creature. My mother would tell you, if she could, about her life with my father, a strange and sometimes cruel gentleman. She would tell you about the choices a young black woman faces. Is falling in with some man a deal with the devil in blue terms? the tongue we use when we don't want nuance to get in the way, when we need to talk straight. My mother chooses my father after choosing a man who was, as we sing it, of no account. This man made my father look good. That's how bad it was. He made my father seem like an island in the middle of a stormy sea. He made my father look like a rock. And is the blues the moment you realize you exist in a stacked deck? You look at a mirror at your young face, the face my sister carries, and you know it's the only leverage you've got. Does this create a hurt that whispers, how you gonna do? Is the blues the moment you shrug your shoulders and agree? A girl without money is nothing. Dust to be pushed about by any old breeze. Compared to this, my father seems, briefly, to be a fire escape. This is the way the blues works its sorry wonders. Makes trouble look like a feather bed. Makes the wrong man's kisses a healing.
We've been talking with Cornelius Eady, the award-winning poet. Thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Thanks for inviting me.
I'm Judy Valente.
Cornelius Eady is also the composer, lyricist, and lead singer of the Cornelius Eady Trio. You're listening to Mark in Time from the group's new LP, Field Recordings.
Wears bright boring shoes. We tap dance down the street as the horns got ready to sound the retreat.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find the Sound Ideas podcast along with the individual interviews you heard today. Thanks to Judy Valente and Willis Kern. WGLT.org is also where you can leave a comment about Sound Ideas. You can also post at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Defense Department says it's investigating retired Lieutenant General Mike Flynn's payments from Russia. That news brought yet more trouble for the former National Security Advisor, as NPR's Philip Ewing explains.
The House Oversight Committee has now released a letter from the Pentagon's Inspector General explaining the inquiry. Flynn was warned in 2014 that he needed approval before taking payments from foreign sources. His attorney says he briefed defense officials about a trip he took to Moscow that involved a dinner with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. But House lawmakers say there's no evidence Flynn ever sought or received the permission he needed to be paid the tens of thousands of dollars he got from Russian entities. Flynn has offered to tell his full story to congressional investigators in exchange for immunity from prosecution, but so far they have not agreed. Philip Ewing, NPR News, Washington.
Stating that suddenly ending NAFTA would be a shock to the system, President Trump says instead he's willing to renegotiate the Clinton-era pact among the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. Spokesman Sean Spicer says the president discussed as much in conversations with the U.S. neighbors yesterday over the phone.
Part of this is to look at not just the existing agreement, but areas and sectors and industries that have fallen outside or because over the last couple decades have not kept up with what the promises and the commitments that were made. But we've got a ways to go.
Trump has repeatedly criticized NAFTA as great for other countries, but a bad deal for American workers. The Israeli military says its Patriot missile defense system has intercepted a projectile from Syria over Golan Heights. Local media reporting Israeli forces blocked a drone out of Syria. Earlier, Syria accused Israel of hitting its military installation near Damascus International Airport. French mainstream opposition to electing the far right is weaker. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports people are reacting differently to Marine Le Pen making the second round than they did to her father placing in the runoff in 2002.
There's a video circulating on social media that juxtaposes Marine Le Pen's first-round victory speech with her father's.
Cette chance historique de redressement national.
Il est temps désormais de libérer le peuple français.
Libérer.
But there are big differences this time around. Jean-Marie Le Pen making the runoff was a fluke made possible by the huge number of people who didn't vote. Marine Le Pen won because of large support. Since 2002, Marine Le Pen has mainstreamed the National Front by moving away from xenophobic rhetoric and embracing workers struggling against globalization. Le Pen's father was trounced in the second round by Jacques Chirac and got less than 20% of the vote. Analysts say daughter Marine Le Pen will do a lot better. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The Dow is up 11 points at 20,986. NASDAQ is up 20, S&P up 2. This is NPR News. The American Medical Association is opposing the Congressional Republicans' new health care legislation that has been proposed. A doctors group, the largest in the nation, says that under the new proposal, insurers could effectively make coverage completely unaffordable to people with pre-existing conditions. House Speaker Paul Ryan has been lobbying support for the latest version of repeal and replace legislation that initially failed to win enough Republican backing to be put to a full vote in the House. NASA has regained contact with the Cassini spacecraft that's orbiting Saturn. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports that means the probe survived an unprecedented dive through the net.